You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2003 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother John Bellello on the subject, Paul's Letter from Habakkuk.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, thank you. I was very impressed that many years ago, Mary and I were in China. I think it was about 1984. And we went to the classroom, and whatever the professor said, the whole class repeated it. And when the professor said good morning, they all got up and saluted him. It was really impressive. I must honestly say that at the university, this has never happened. Although there are times classes have gotten up and threatened things. Today's class is going to focus on Habakkuk number 2. And we're going to take a very serious and deep look at this prophet. This class is not about prophecy. It's about a prophet. So it differs from the other two classes, and a very wonderfully intertwined program, by the way. Again, I thank the planners of the school for careful planning or extraordinarily good luck. And that's not so bad. Luck does count. The Habakkuk is about a prophet. And his prophecies are not aimed at all the evil and wicked children of Israel, as so many other prophets are. His prophecy and the intent of his book is aimed at the believer, at the faithful. And so in many ways, Habakkuk talks to us today in very strong terms about the issues and problems of our day. I want you to recall a few things from yesterday. And that first one is that one of our main conclusions was that faith is an important concept. It's mentioned 229 times, at least, in the New Testament, once in the Old Testament. And those of you who have been, perhaps have heard me speak before, I do have a tendency to repeat myself. This follows John Bellello's rule 21-B, that if something is mentioned a lot, it's important. And it's extraordinarily interesting to me that through my life that I've found that Christadelphians often focus and put tremendous attention on a verse, an obscure verse, or one that's not very clear, and make a tremendous fuss about something. There's a verse in 1 Corinthians 11, which I will not mention here, that often raises controversy. And yet, something that's mentioned hundreds of times, we don't always pay attention to it or even bother studying why it's important and what it means. It is very clear that almost all the uses of the word pistis in the New Testament do not refer to a set of facts. And so, since I'm an equal opportunity abuser, I'm going to say that names like the statement of faith or a confession of faith are probably misnomers. They should really be titled a statement of a set of facts in which we believe in. Except that's an awkward title. So there's only one or two cases, actually, where faith is used as a noun, and it's even a stretch in those cases to consider it as a list of important facts. So please keep that in mind when we think about faith. And it's not a statement of faith or a confession of faith that's going to save us. It's the biblical definition of faith that's important. The other thing, and I drew this from one of my slides yesterday, is Paul draws our attention to the fact that faith is a complete new attitude of mind. That's what is really important. And Paul didn't make this up. He used Habakkuk as the foundation stone of his theology. And Habakkuk's message and how he deals with the problems of his age are extremely important in terms of the life of believers throughout all ages, not just at the time of Habakkuk, who happened to live almost contemporary with Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel. What a wonderful age that was for prophecy. Actually, the Apostle Paul built his definition of faith on the words of the Lord Jesus Christ, who used the word many, many times himself. But he used Habakkuk as the foundation to give it Old Testament legitimacy and continuity, which was important because God does not change his mind. Now, let's just remember a little bit, and I just picked out some of these, of how Jesus Christ used faith. None of these mean a list of facts. Okay? Talking about the grass of the field, he says, which day is, and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall not he much more clothe ye, O ye of little faith? And he wasn't talking about them having a small knowledge of some fact. He was talking about them not having the power of their convictions. And again, in Matthew 8:26, he says, "Oh, why are ye fearful, O ye of little faith?" This is when they walked out in the sea, and Peter came, tried to get out of the boat, and he sank. Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. Well, I don't know about you, but I know about me. I don't even like getting in the water, you know, when it's not in a boat, when it's in a storm, let alone walking on the water. But again, he's not talking about a list of facts. He's talking about the power and persuasive conviction of these people that they would do something like that, that if the Lord told them, get out on the water or I can do it, that they would feel they could do it. And Matthew, again, and immediately Jesus stretched forth his hands and caught him and said, "O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt?" And again, he's talking about the power of the conviction that this person was so motivated by what he believed that he could do great things. And again in Matthew, which when Jesus perceived, he said unto them, "O ye of little faith, why reason ye among yourselves? It's because we have brought no bread." And that's when they had to feed the 5,000, and they didn't feel they had enough, and they couldn't run out, as sometimes we do in our ecclesia when we have too many more people come, we go out to McDonald's or Kentucky Fried Chicken or something and get some more. They were stuck. The supermarkets were closed, and they had to make, but they didn't have faith that the Lord would provide. And he wasn't talking about providing a bunch of facts, but providing food in this case. And then in Luke 12:28, "If when God so clothed the grass," is just a repeat of here, and I'm stopping at this point because you see I can pick up a lot of other gospel message which repeat what he had in Matthew. So this is how Jesus impressed upon us the need for faith. It's the power of our conviction. We are so persuaded by the gospel message that we live a life of faith. That's what he's talking about. Okay, we're going to go now to Habakkuk, and let's go to Habakkuk chapter 1, and we're going to talk about the burden of Habakkuk. And this prophet is different from the other prophets in that his burden is brought right to us, the believer, those who wanted to be faithful in Israel. And these people were a distinct minority. And they had a deep and powerful religious problem with what was about to happen. Now, when did Habakkuk write this book? Well, there's several different thoughts on this, and I will just bring them to your attention, and you can judge for yourself. I'm not sure that it's very important what you believe. In fact, I'm absolutely sure it isn't important what you believe. But some have said he was in the time of Jehoiakim, from 609 to 598 B.C., and so that would place him right contemporary just with the Babylonian invasion and toward the very younger years of Daniel and the middle years of Jeremiah. Others have said that he was during the age of Manasseh, some 30 years earlier, and that he was preparing Israel for the bad times that were to come ahead and for the prophecies which were eventually to be given them by Jeremiah and Ezekiel. I don't think it really matters much which you believe. The important thing is that Habakkuk takes place before the final Babylonian invasion and the deportation of Israel, at least of the rulers and the upper classes, to Babylon. It starts out with a burden. And what was his burden? Why did he have a burden? Well, all prophets have had burdens because prophets have not been very popular people. It is said that, and if you've read and remember Hebrews chapter 11, there's some really horrible things that happened to prophets, including being sawn in half. And it is thought that that exactly happened, actually, through Jewish tradition, happened to Isaiah during the reign of Manasseh. So being a prophet was a burden. And I know that we like to think that when we preach the gospel message that we're going to be popular. And, of course, we all know if we've done this sincerely that we're not. And there's nothing more a cold water in the face type of thing than going door to door and having a lot of doors slammed in your face. I never did really enjoy that, but sometimes it actually works. And there's nothing more frustrating sometimes than after Bible seminars teaching people for maybe several years and never getting anywhere. But the object of preaching is not to be successful. There is not one word in Scripture that says that there's a benefit analysis, a cost-benefit analysis to preaching. This is kind of modern thinking where, you know, how much money did we spend and is it worthwhile doing? And I always like to tell the story because it's an absolutely true story to give you an idea that God works differently completely from the way we work. There is an ecclesia in the New York area that in 1945 and 46, realizing what happened with the Holocaust and everything, was a good time to get back and do some preaching work. And they were not particularly anxious to do preaching work and hadn't done any for about 15, 20 years. Partly through the depression and everything, it was pretty expensive and everything to do it, and during the war it was difficult, but they felt they ought to get back and do it. And so in 1946, they had a preaching campaign on the restoration of Israel. Wonderful time to do it, wasn't it? Well, they did this for 6 weeks, and only one person came. And they got so frustrated with that this ecclesia never had another lecture campaign until, I don't know, till this day, I think. It happened that the one person who came to this meeting joined their meeting. And down through the years, so did his children, two of them, and his grandchildren, and the people that they taught the truth. And I traced it back one time that there were about 66 people who came into the truth as a result of this one person coming into the truth in 1945. And by 1980s, there were 66 people, all traced back to the lineage of this one person, and that ecclesia could not see that their campaign was a success. And it took 30 years, of course, for this to bring all that fruit. But it was a complete success. Imagine if they brought in two people. So I think that we should never get frustrated with our burden. Now, he calls himself a prophet. It's interesting. I could not find any other prophet so labeling himself as being of that profession. Now, usually it's cast by someone else. So he definitely knew his mission and his task. By the way, just for interest, look at Genesis 20 and verse 7, and you'll see it calls Abraham a prophet. And but it's not Abraham who is saying that. It's Genesis 20 and 7. And this is in the case where Abraham went to Abimelech. And he says, "And now therefore restore the man his wife, for he is a prophet, and he shall pray for thee, and thou shalt live, and if thou restore her not, know that thou shalt surely die," etc. So it's clear that he was a prophet, but it's someone else calling him that. And the same with Moses, Deuteronomy 34 and 10. Moses never actually ever calls himself a prophet. At least not nowhere that I could find. And that's Deuteronomy 34 and 10. And he says, start with verse 9 for connection. "And Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands upon him. And the children of Israel hearkened unto him, and did as the Lord commanded Moses. And there arose not a prophet since in Israel like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face." Again, and just for sake of if you're taking notes, or if the tape actually works today, 1 Samuel 3 and 20. 1 Kings 18 and 22, Jeremiah 1 and 5, Ezekiel 2 and 5, Acts 3 and 22, and Acts 2 and 30. All of those are indirect references to someone being a prophet. Habakkuk is the only person I could find that was a direct reference. So if you do find another one, do let me know. But it's obvious that it's pretty rare that a person knew exactly what he had to do. He knew what his burden was to do it, and he did it. Now, we're going to look to point out another sort of interesting note. A little while back in Michigan and in Grand Rapids, there's a very nice museum, and they had an exhibit of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's kind of interesting to go to Grand Rapids, which is a small Midwestern town of a couple hundred thousand people, and all of a sudden, where you've never even seen a policeman, you see all kinds of security because they were having this exhibit, which they were afraid might be a target for terrorists. So in this little museum that we've been to many times before, which kind of peaceful small town thing, had security that would make most airports blush. But they had there the scroll of Habakkuk from Qumran, and it's one of the seven original scrolls. And Isaiah, of course, is the most famous as being in complete state. I don't know how you feel about things, but I feel when something like this happens, it doesn't just happen by accident. God is the author and the director of the ages, And again, it may be just a point to saying, hey, maybe you guys ought to pay attention to this book in these latter days. It was found, actually, one day before they officially became a nation. In May, the United Nations declared it, and on November 30th, 48, was the day they declared it themselves and opened up. So when did Habakkuk get written? We already talked about the two schools of thought, and why was it written? That's what we really want to focus on in today's class. It was written to deal with a religious problem that affects believers, not those who are going astray, not those who do not care for God, but people who sincerely and honestly do their very best to follow God. And we will have problems. We will all have problems. There will be difficulties in life. There is never and never, we should never put in our minds the idea that we're going to get a free ride, that somehow nothing horrible will ever happen to us because we are in the truth and we're sincere and hard workers in it. That is a bad way of thinking. And if something horrible happens to someone else, we shouldn't assume, well, they did something wrong. There must be something in their life that they were punished for. That's a totally wrong thinking also. So Habakkuk wants to deal with a religious problem. Some very horrible things were going to come upon the nation of Israel. And brethren and sisters, and if there's any young people here, I want you to realize that God didn't put a dome over the religious minority, the faithful minority, and protect them from all the horrors that came upon them by Nebuchadnezzar. He didn't draw them all aside and put them up on some mountain and protect them and say, well, look, don't worry about it. It's just going to come and hit all those bad people. That's not the way it happened at all. When the time of the end comes, brothers and sisters, I hope and pray that we don't lose our faith because some of the horrors that come upon the world affect us too. Now, too often I have read in our own literature that, well, we're all going to be drawn away to Jerusalem and all protected. Well, I'm not sure exactly when that happens. And we shouldn't take for granted that will happen. In fact, the more I see charismatic Christians believing in the rapture, that they're all going to be drawn away and protected, the more they believe in that, the more I'm worried that that's not at all what's going to happen. All right? So if you want to know the truth, often it's the opposite of what most people are thinking. Okay, the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, actually, Chaldeans is actually a better phrase used in the authorized version than Babylonians, because the Babylonians were the head of a confederacy of Chaldean people. And the Babylonians were a very evil people. We should never in any way think that the Babylonians were somehow a righteous tribe of people that came to punish Israel. They were evil in every way possible. Just as evil as the Romans were, and cruel and ruthless as the Romans were, or the Assyrians. And somehow, I think in the United States, we have this attitude that there's something like a clean war. Because there's the Geneva Conventions, and we're really good guys. We never do anything bad, except occasionally, like at Mile and a few other places, which are aberrations. Right? There's nothing clean about war. If you heard Ken's class earlier, some of you may have been teaching other classes, I think he pointed out very well. There's nothing clean about war. It's horrible. And the mentality of generals was a lot worse in times past and can get worse in these days. There was clearly an incident in World War I that I will never forget reading about it when the Germans attacked Verdun and the French had entrenched position with machine guns, and the French took losses of about 70%. Actually, I think it was more than that, 75-80%. The Germans took losses of about 65%. Petain, who was the German general directing the battle, said, well, at this rate, we'll win. Well, because he had more troops than the Germans did. And it's not the first time in history that's happened. Well, the Chaldeans came, and they were a very fierce people. They were very heavily armed. They had weapons of mass destruction because they were all armed to the teeth. Their armies, and there are many pictures and there are bas reliefs in various museums around the world showing the armor of these people. They were also very disciplined at it. Not as disciplined as the Romans, but very disciplined compared to the Jews, who were not really skilled in warfare. And so the question comes up, why did God use these evil people to chastise Israel. After all, the Jews weren't all bad. The Jews tried to follow their God, and there was really a remnant in that nation that was pretty religious. And this is the question that Habakkuk raises. Why does he use evil people? This question. And that question has come up in our own history, and of course the older people in the room have a fresher memory of this, and maybe some of us too fresh in memory. Why did God use Hitler to drive Israel back to their land? Millions of Jews died. If you've ever visited a concentration camp, you're absolutely going to be appalled at what you see. It just breaks your heart. And why did he do that? Well, I can give you one reason, because there was no other way to do it. As long as the Jews were in Europe and prosperous and doing very well, as they did in Germany and Austria-Hungary and other nations, they had achieved into the intelligentsia, everywhere from people like Einstein, who had the biggest chair in the University of Berlin, to medical doctors and lawyers, as long as they were comfortable and materialistically comfortable, there's no way in the world that they were ever going to go back to Israel. The Jews, in fact, could have gone back to Israel from 1897 on, and Rothschild had family, had provided various means in the development of the kibbutz, but that was only for the poor stragglers. The bulk of the comfortable Jews in Europe were assimilated. In fact, they weren't even very religious in Germany. There was no other way to drive them. The other issue is, who was going to give them Israel? Would the nations of the world have allowed, would you think the United Nations would have voted unanimously to allow them to go back and have that land? In fact, in 1948, it is the only time that the United States and Russia voted in agreement at the UN until Glasnost, 40 years later. I think it was out of guilt. So the nations of the world and the Jewish people themselves would have never done it. And so this evil came upon them. Now, it's horrible to us. And that doesn't ever make it right or justified. But somehow, in history, people have to be driven to do what the ultimate purpose of goodness will bring about. And that is God's blessing on everyone. Okay, Habakkuk asked this question. And if you just turn to down in this first chapter, and we're going to go through this chapter in some detail, because like a lot of scientists, well, I like to look at something at a big distance first, then put a magnifier glass on it, and then maybe a microscope and an electron microscope and so on, and we look at it at a finer scale, you reveal more and more detail. And then finally you get down to such detail no one understands it at all, but that's okay. Verse 13, "Thou art of pure eyes than to behold evil, and cannot look on iniquity. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest thy tongue when the wicked devour the man that is more righteous than he?" So he's talking about the Chaldeans here primarily, but it's also a general religious problem. Why is it that evil men are allowed to devour righteous people? And a rabbi recently wrote a book a couple of years back called Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. And he actually used Habakkuk as one of his frameworks. And it is this interesting question. Interesting is a very weak word. It is a powerful question that we need to answer. Because all of us, I guarantee you, at some point in your life, you will not get out of this place, this planet, alive. I can guarantee you. At some point in your life, you will feel serious illness and pain. Someone close to you will die. Some tragedy will happen that cannot be foreseen. I guarantee it. I don't like it. I'm not anxious to see it myself. It's happened to me a few times, and it will probably happen more. But we cannot ever forget that that is the way life is. Another question that Habakkuk asks is, given that evil seems to triumph over good in the world, what should be the response of those who seek after righteousness to this dilemma? Now, too often, the response is lack of faith in its ultimate and correct sense. We lose our conviction. We're no longer fully persuaded. Have you ever heard this said of someone, well, if God could let that happen, how can I believe in that God? I mean, that in one form or other, I have heard that many, many times. And so this is a religious question that has come up throughout all the ages, and it is one that will plague all of us. And I know particularly many of my Jewish friends who lost relatives in the Holocaust and everything say, how could they believe in a God that would allow this to happen? In the end, I hope we will come to the answer that how can we not believe in a God that will allow this to happen? Because this is why the foundation of this book is so important and built on in the New Testament. Because faith is really the key. If we take away the real meaning of faith in our lives, then nothing else will ever, ever keep us on the track to the kingdom. The first time the wind blows, the first time we're in a storm, the first time we have a pain, the first time we see someone suffer, we will question God, and we will not fully understand His purpose with the earth. Okay, let's go into a little bit of the background of the Babylonians so we can get an appreciation of what these people were like and what they did. This was a great nation. It truly was the head of gold that is spoken of in Daniel. And their power was to come upon Israel. The Babylonian power was great. Their army was many times the size of Israel. If you remember back about a century before them, the Assyrians came down upon the northern tribes and 185,000 men died in one night. The Babylonians, it is said, probably came against Jerusalem with at least 50% to 100% more, between 300,000 and 400,000 men. That was a very large army in those days. That's actually a fairly large army even in this day. Okay, what were they like? Well, they were in southern Iraq, and I'll show you a map in a moment. We've seen some maps before. Their power was based, in fact, they're not very far from present-day Babylon. Interestingly, we're living in times when the same area of the world has become tremendously important. It is believed that the nation was named from the roots of the Tower of Babel, and that it was in the same general area, meaning confusion. Again, I give you what I've seen in a number of history books. There's always minority opinions with historians. They had introduced a code of justice around the same era as the law of Moses, about a couple of hundred years earlier, by one of their most established and founding rulers, Hammurabi. And they were very fierce warriors. They didn't like taking prisoners. But when they did, they deported them. And quite often, if the army captured someone, they took a couple hundred thousand prisoners. You shouldn't think that they followed the Geneva Convention and they put them in a camp and they fed them and took care of them and all that. No. Most of the people who carried weapons were killed. That was the rule. In fact, I think I don't have this slide with me, but I showed it at the Great Lake Bible School. There's a wall relief taken from Nimrod that's in the British Museum, and it shows the Assyrian troops holding up the heads. And what they were doing is the commander of each brigade is counting the heads so that he knows how many they slay. And that's, of course, where the expression head count comes from. So next time you take a head count of the audience, what you're really doing is how many chopped off heads there are in that audience. So this is the way they dealt with prisoners. They would then deport as many people, usually of the upper classes, to break the back of the nation's ability to govern. And they built lots of major engineering works, irrigation works. The walls of Babylon are quite well known. I'm going to show you a few pictures, some of which I've pulled from books and some of which I've taken myself at the Pergamon Museum in Berlin. The walls of Babylon were not only massive, they were beautiful. They were all covered with bas relief tile, very, very professionally done for a long time. It is said that the walls encompassed 60 miles in circumference, and they were wide enough for two chariots to drive on, so you could go in either direction. Here's where Babylon exists. It's down not too far from Ur. We'll see in a minute a map of the modern era, but it's on the Euphrates River. This area of the world is now, of course, Iraq. And here is here's Babylon. Here's Nasiriya, which you've heard a lot about in the news. Here's Basra, which you've heard about in the news. And then up here is Baghdad. So it's about 60 miles, I believe, south of Baghdad, the ruins. Here's a modern image of the Tower of Babel. I'm afraid you can't see it too well with all these lights, so I'm just going to pass to the next one. This is a more ancient image. Can you dim it a bit? Oh, that's good. This one I really like because it's by Bruegel, 16th century artist. And here's the thing of Hammurabi from a bas relief in the British Museum. And he is considered really the founding of the dynasty of powerful Babylonian lords. And then for the next probably almost 10 centuries, think about this a minute, how history works out. Because this country's a little over 200 years old. We're a sneeze on history, all right? But about 1792 to 1750 B.C. would place him probably a few hundred years before Moses. The Hammurabi Code, which is sometimes cited as a precursor to the Law of Moses, has some things in common, but has awful, even a great deal of cruelty in it also, which is not any element of the Law of Moses. And here's a picture of what the walls of Babylon looked like by an artist with the Zurichites. And they had many of these in Babylon, which were sometimes thought to be emblematic of the Tower of Babel, but they were actually temples and sacrifices were held at the top of it. And so high places were a favorite place to have sacrifice. You got closer to heaven and the gods. And here's a picture of the ruins in black and white at Babylon. And you can see the walls, and they're really massive. Located along the Euphrates River. They developed in stages, and it reached its peak during the under Nebuchadnezzar II, who is the person who destroyed Jerusalem. And this was a capital city. I'm not sure exactly what the population is. I've actually seen in the literature anywhere from 250,000 to a million. So it's hard to actually frame it, and it's hard to know whether that was all within the city walls or also around the periphery. But remember, we're talking 2,600 years ago. This was considered at that time, and people still consider it to be the greatest city in the world at its time. At that time, by the way, Rome was not even existent. It wasn't a village yet. Romulus and Remus would have come along about 100 years later. Britain was basically an outpost of barbarians, which may have changed, I'm not sure. Here's the wall of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon by a modern artist's definition, but I don't really think they look that way. Here's a picture by a 16th century Dutch artist, Martin, and I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce that name. Heemskerk, I believe, is close. And this may be a little close, I'm not really sure. I doubt that they had all of these columns. But nevertheless, Nebuchadnezzar built this because he had a Median wife, and she was very lonely for her countryside, and so she wanted a garden. So he built her a very, very vast garden that was watered, presumably by hydraulics, and so it was built to please his wife. It seems to me that that was a very nice thing to do because we all us married men know that that's a top priority. All right? Well, evil still triumphs in the modern world. It's not just in ancient times that the Babylonians did evil and came upon it. And he says, "Behold, ye among the heathen, and regard wonder marvelously, I will work a work in your days which ye will not believe, though it be told you." Now, if I can have the lights back, because we're not going to see any more pictures for a while, so I can see my Bible. Thank you. Okay, so he was going to work a work in the days of the people reading this book. And that work was going to be something quite amazing. God eventually was going to bring judgment upon Israel. But notice, this has been going on for centuries. And Ken showed you Joel, for example, which was 8th to 9th century. We're down to the 6th century. God is very patient. From the time of the division of the kingdom, about 1000 B.C., till the time of the Babylonians, I don't believe that the northern tribes, who disappeared about a century, ever had a single good king. Judah and Benjamin had a few good ones, but they also had some really, really terrible ones, horrible ones. And it's not even logical sometimes because you had this great king Hezekiah who fails in his old age and then has a son Manasseh who is one of the worst kings that Israel ever had. So genetics and nurturing sometimes don't count for anything. Take a look at 2 Peter chapter 3 and 9. And I want to put this in a little bit of a modern context. And now I'm going to just read back from verse 8 for connection. So 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 9. Finally, be ye all of one mind, having compassion one of another. Love as brethren, be pitiful, be courteous, not rendering evil for evil, or railing for railing, but contrariwise blessing, knowing that ye are there upon to call, that ye should inherit a blessing. So, this action of responding to evil with evil is absolutely wrong, especially within the brotherhood. Because he says we should have compassion one on another, love as brethren, be pitiful, be courteous. Now, Israel was going to be punished by an evil people, and he was going to bring a work in their days, and none of this was going to matter. Now, sometimes we're tempted to return evil with evil because it's the way the world is. Everyone has in their ecclesial constitution, after you have the confession of faith or the statement of faith, it always comes down to, and the commandments of Christ. And what commandment of Christ is the least followed commandment of Christ in our brotherhood? Love one another as I have loved you. The second one is, turn the other cheek. I don't even know if I have another cheek. Because when someone's on us, the first reaction is to, if we don't agree with them, or if we're having a problem with a brother or sister, or there's a difficulty, or there's someone we don't like, we don't turn the other cheek, we turn the other fist. And I think this is a very difficult thing to walk away from evil. I mean, that's the thing that we don't always get. Jesus didn't say, turn the other cheek, except when you're right. There are no exceptions. Okay, so for many centuries, judgment was to come upon Israel by the Babylonians, and was predicted by Isaiah long back. So Habakkuk was just repeating this message. And I think we ought to see this, because Isaiah was in the reigns of Hezekiah, Jotham, and so on, down into Manasseh's age. Isaiah lived a long time before he ended up presumably with a horrible ending. So for almost at least a century before, this was well known, what Habakkuk just summarizes actually in just one or two verses, because he's taking it for granted that the people knew what was going to happen to them. Isaiah 39, verses 5 through 8. And I'm going to start at verse 3 for connection. And then came Isaiah the prophet unto King Hezekiah, and said unto him, what said these men, and whence came they unto thee? And this is when the Babylonian ambassadors came to visit Hezekiah, because they heard he had gotten well from this illness. And Hezekiah said, they are come from far country unto me, even from Babylon. Then said he, what have they seen in thine house? And Hezekiah answered, all that is in mine house have they seen. There is nothing among my treasures that I have not showed them. Then said Isaiah to Hezekiah, hear the words of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house, and that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day, shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. And of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Then said Hezekiah to Isaiah, good is the word of the Lord which thou hast spoken. And he said moreover, for there shall be peace and truth in my days. And by the way, I've always thought that that referred also to Daniel, who was one of the princes and who had been in with the eunuch. And I think Daniel was probably an eunuch. It's something we don't really focus on, but I think that probably was the case. And so they knew for a long time that these punishment was going to come upon them. And the prophet Habakkuk is trying to speak to the people. I'm going to take a little bit of look at this chapter, almost verse by verse, because I think the magnifying glass really pays off here. We've talked about the burden, and we've talked about how long shall I cry? And why was the Lord crying? Why was he saying, oh Lord, how long shall you cry? Because there was great violence in the land of Israel. People took what they wanted by force. It wasn't just going back to the northern tribes when Ahab and Jezebel schemed to get Naboth's vineyard. It was a way of life. And you find that when society breaks down, that's the way of life. Very intriguing that we don't understand this today. Here the United States, for example, goes into Iraq. They completely disrupt the infrastructure of the country, and in a place where people can all pick up guns, and then we're kind of shocked that public order breaks down. If you live in Detroit, you've got a pretty good feeling. Public order breaks down real easily. If you take away the veneer of civilization, what was it that Churchill once said, that civilization is just a veneer over the jungle? Take away that little coating and we're back in the jungle. Well, Iraq is a perfect example. These people looted their greatest national treasures. But you know something? I can understand this. I'll bet if the same thing happened in New York, the Metropolitan Museum of Art would be emptied in 10 minutes. And I'd probably be asking what the price was on a few Rembrandts myself. I mean, that is the way we are, and that's the way Israel was. They were filled with violence, people taking what they want, spoiling, and raising up strife and contention between brethren. Gee, that's kind of shocking. But this was a way of life in Israel. And contention and strife were emblematic of their religious culture. I think that one of my favorite authors is I.B. Singer. And he once said that if you put 10 Jews in the room, you got 20 opinions. And after a couple of hours of arguing, they didn't even remember which opinion they were arguing for. Now, I wonder what he would say about 10 Christadelphians in a room. Interesting concept. I think I'll try and do this quantitatively sometime. Maybe there's something about us, you know, we say with modern-day Jews, and to some extent we've also picked up a lot of their bad habits. And we picked up their bad habits because for some of the same reasons. You can get arrogant about what you believe. You can lose humility. You can look around the rest of the evil world and think, geez, we're really good. Well, we're not. He says, the law is not slack, and judgment doth never go forth. It wasn't the fault of the law of Moses. And the faults, whatever we may have in our community, are not about what we believe. Our beliefs, I believe, are as sound today as they were 150 years ago. The fault lies in us and our character and what we've done to implement it. And he says, wicked doth compass the righteous. So it seems sometimes like wickedness is completely surrounding us. And therefore, wrong judgment proceeded. Or I think in the NIV it says wrong judgment. I think the word here is mishpat, justice. There's no justice. And so we feel, I feel sometimes that I am surrounded with evil. And that's, you know, that's just locally. Because it's very difficult sometimes to work through problems and issues. And we get very frustrated. Because we want it on our time scale, not on God's time scale. And where does he go? He says, I will make this work, and he was going to raise up the Chaldeans. Now, this is what really creates the crux of the religious problem for Habakkuk. Because here's all this evil in Israel, but there still is some righteousness. And the people felt that the good people felt they were surrounded by wickedness. The wicked had surrounded the few righteous that were left. But instead of sending a righteous people to punish them, or the angels, or something like that, he raises up a bitter and hasty or impetuous people. And this is the Babylonians. He sends upon them a very, very evil nation to do this punishment. Now, if you look at this whole concept about evil being punished, sometimes we just don't recognize the extent of what God does and how he does it. It doesn't follow the logic of human thinking. Well, why should that surprise us? Take a look, for example, at Ecclesiastes chapter 8. And there's a very interesting passage there about punishment of evil. And it's a passage that I often recall to mind when I'm thinking about issues of how I would like evil to be punished. Chapter 8 of Ecclesiastes. verse 11. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily. And notice what the prophet said. He said, how long? Let's go back. How long? How long are you going to wait? How long are you going to wait? He's going to bring the work in their days. But how long did he deal with this? Well, he dealt with it for almost four centuries. By the way, that's something to think about when we're trying to solve problems that are wrong in our own community. Sometimes we get really impatient if they don't happen in a year or 2 years or 5 years or, you know. And I'm not sure that God has ever given us a time measure for solving wrongs. I do know what he has told us. He has told us that wrong has to be fought. And I'm not sure whether I'll be part of the solution or maybe someone else who follows me. I do know, though, when I see something I feel is wrong, that I'm going to do my best to make it right. And if it takes my whole lifetime and I pass it on to someone else, okay, that's what the Lord has decided. It took Noah 120 years to build the ark, so God waited a long time to judge that generation. And I just got this feeling that my time scale is not God's time scale. And so I intend to be as patient as I can, given my Sicilian heritage. All right? So here the question comes up, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. So because a lightning bolt doesn't come down and strike someone who's doing evil, we say, geez, God doesn't hear. He's not paying attention. Where is he? Well, isn't it great, though? Would we like it the other way around? The minute we did something wrong, are we ready for the lightning bolt to hit us? Absolutely not. We want God to be patient with our failings. But the attitude of mind here is what's dangerous. Because we may get away with evil. Things may be wrong or bad for a long time. We should never deceive ourselves into thinking that God has forgotten. It may be that he is being extremely patient. And the day of his patience may run out. And then where will we be? Go back to Habakkuk. So he was going to raise up these evil Chaldeans to punish the nation. And this terrible and dreadful people, we've gotten a chance to look a little bit at them, and they were indeed people of great technology and great evil. And he says he's going to bring upon them horses which are swifter than leopards and more fierce than the evening wolves, and their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from far, and they shall fly as the eagle that hasteneth to eat. And they shall come all for violence. Now, here in the Hebrew, there's a play on the words. Because earlier, remember, in the chapter, he talked about the violence in Israel. And some of this book is written in blank verse, what we call free verse. I'm going to talk about that later. And so this play on words is, you had violence, you're going to get violence. Something like that. Very nice, beautiful symmetry. It's a little lost in the English. But you brought violence to your people, and evil, I'm going to bring evil and violence to your people. And he says, and I will gather the captivity as the sand. So he was going to take away and do a very thorough job of taking the Jews out of the land. And they shall scoff at the kings, and the princes shall be scorn unto them. So they paid no attention to any of the Israelite kings. They were nothing to them. And I think Ken mentioned how they put out Zedekiah's eyes, and he never did get to see Babylon. And they shall deride every stronghold, for they shall heap dust. Now, the very city of Jerusalem that the Assyrians couldn't take, the Babylonians heaped up the dirt, and they built banks and ramps up to the city walls, and with the waves of troops, they took the city. So the Assyrians, who had been stopped outside the city by the power of God, this did not happen when the Babylonians came, and they built these ramps. They literally heaped up the dust from the ground outside the city and built these ramps. And finally, he says, and they shall change his mind, and he shall pass over and offend, imputing this his power to his God. And this is where we're going to go tomorrow. We're going to talk about how Nebuchadnezzar takes this city and in his life imputes the results of his great victory to his God, which was Evil Merodach. So we will Let's see. Yeah, we will do this tomorrow. That's where I want to end. We'll take a look at Nebuchadnezzar's moves after he takes Jerusalem. Thank you very much.